Thank you, Anselm. Thank you, everyone, being here. Anselm, you forgot Susanne Leeb as a member of the working group, but that's with these words. I also want to give a shout to the people demonstrating and outside at in the government's district. Many of them who planned to come to the conference cannot exit the area right now. I just received text messages, so this is also for them. And we have another reason to be really angry about the AfD. I start right away. On August 27, 1934, on the holiday island Belle-Île en Mer off the coast of Brittany, about 55 inmates of a penal colony for young delinquents, minor homeless and vagabond youth, escaped the confines of the prison-like structure where they were incarcerated, an architecture that adorned, as you see here, postcards to be sent either from those imprisoned or those lingering on the island for a vacation. The breakout happened after one of the young inmates had been brutally punished by guards in the penitentiary's refectory for having tasted the cheese before finishing his soup. In solidarity, anger, and despair, the boys attacked the guards, climbed the walls of the fortress, and dispersed over the island. At the time, many families were spending their vacations on Belle-Île, and if they have needed some more exercise besides sunbathing, some of the vacationers participated in a violent chase of the revolting boys over the island to gain a premium. You see some of those, Jeanette, on the left, three of them participated participated in the chase. The escalated situation quickly made the news. A much-reported fait divers that circulated widely in French popular culture, particularly in sensationalist journals such as Detective. The August 1934 évasion, as they were called, could be read as a symptom of a larger crisis in education and law enforcement, as a revolt against an entire moribund system of more or less clandestine houses and camps of detention organized in a network of penitentiaries and forced labor camps, the so-called banlieues, that were spread around continental France and the colonies. Largely due to the engagement of Alexis Darnon, a reporter committed to the cause of children's rights who worked with the newspaper Paris Soir and authored books on the penal colony in Cayenne in French Guiana, 1934, and a monograph titled Torture Houses on the situation of imprisoned children from 1936. The media coverage entailed successive reforms of juvenile laws in France in the following years, though the penal colony of Belle-Île itself shouldn't change much for many years after the mutiny due to its insular location. Facts and rumors about abandoned, orphanized, lumpenproletariat childhood spent in carceral confines touched a nerve in French culture already since the 19th century. This is this tombola ticket or this tombola coupon stems from the turn of the century. And in the 1920s and 1930s, the moral panic ensued by sensational accounts of child abuse of all sorts, the scandalization of juvenile detention facilities, were related to a drastic decrease in birth rate and a deep crisis of patriarchy and the Oedipal process in the aftermath of the First World War, repeatedly decried as a moral vacuum and a dangerous loss of virility. Oscillating between compassion and voyeurism, the very anxiety about childhood and the supposed role of children in capitalist disciplinary society should be taken into consideration when reflecting the critical function of appeals to childhood, Neolithic or otherwise, in the formation of aesthetic theories and practices determined to draw on resources beyond the ideals of mature, adult, and arguably masculine art. Adding to the mix of public outcry and sensationalist journalism on the matter of juvenile law enforcement in 1934, an enraged Jacques Prévert wrote La Chasse à l'enfant in a poem in which he particularly stresses the bigot role of the pack of honorable men, the honnêtes gens, that chase the children in the literal and the figurative, the policemen, the tourists, the pensionaries, and, not to forget, the artists. The poem gained even more popularity once it was used for the lyrics of a 1936 chanson composed by Joseph Kusma and performed by singer Marianne Oswald, who, in the words of Jean Cassou, represents the musical history of misery, hunger, anger, and revolt. That Prévert took note and action in the case of the Belle-Île breakout and the subsequent boys' hunt may serve as an indication as to what extent the artistic milieu in the wider environment of the Paris Surrealists has been aware of the news on prison revolts, the problem of juvenile delinquency, the French system of penal colonies, and the occasional escapes of prisoners, the various évasions making front lines and featuring the cover pages of Détective, Vue, Police, etc. Not only was the 1934 Belle-Île incident followed by long articles on the secret archipelago of correctional institutions, such as this one by anti-colonial and anti-prison activist writer Louis Roubaud in the November 5, 1934 issue of Détective, sensationally spiced up illustrated stories on the intolerable conditions of prisons, camps, and penal colonies, as well as on all kinds of revolts and jailbreaks, attracted strong interest among the readership of Faits divers in 1930s France, for reasons, I argue, that bear a relation to the kind of topics and issues that took center stage in contemporary avant-gardist political thought and action, as well as in aesthetic practice. Such connection being established via or across a collective imaginary replete with the suggestive vocabulary of évasion and revolt, and with either images of suffering, incarcerated people or prisoners being set free, like the inmate getting released on the cover of this 1933 issue of Détective, or successfully escaping from life-threatening surroundings, such as in a three-part reportage by Henri d'Anjou on a French doctor who in the late 1920s escaped from a penal colony in French Guiana. Rarely, however, this needs to be emphasized. The suffering, serfdom, neo-slavery, and revolts in the colonies that affected predominantly non-white indigenous people was reported on in any way comparable to this kind of stories, which in the French mainstream press of the 1930s usually remained in the ethnic fold of whiteness. However, alternate advocacy journalism could be found in left-wing papers such as L'Humanité or in the expressly anti-colonialist pamphlets of transnational and pan-African trade unions and other networks of the radical Black Atlantic, such as Légitime Défense or, as you see here, the Negro Worker. Images of slave labor and chain-breaking upheaval in both writing and visual documentation did their work of raising awareness and creating bonds between those directly concerned. The art directors and image photo editors at journals such as Détective often rendered situations of despair, repression, and flight highly suggestive through their design. On the pages of Henri d'Anjou's 1936 story on another mutiny of children and young adults, this time in the penitentiary in the Abbey of Anian in the southeast of France, the dreadful stasis of prison life is getting sparked by a flash symbolizing the revolt ignited by the dismal conditions. The pictures of a life that is being put on hold in the juvenile prison and thus transformed into social death are being dynamically reorganized in the double spreads layout. The documentation of the lamentable state of law enforcement bespeaks the more or less hidden, more or less suppressed realities of colonialism and fascism in the Third Republic. Here it's being mobilized as the material of a vitalizing design, a flash of the now, which signals escape, évasion, from the dungeons of the living death, where the very future of France is being frozen in a state of atemporal tremor, of suffering outside of history rather than being put to the service of progress and civilization. For some months in the early stages of the preparation of the exhibition, before we finally decided on Neolithic Childhood as its title, the working title was Gestaltwandel, that is, change of gestalt, shapeshift. Like Neolithic Childhood, Gestaltwandel would have been a term drawn from Karl Einstein's lexicon, where it's used synonymously with metamorphose, metamorphosis. In a striking passage in the section on Paul Klee from the third edition of his Die Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts, published in 1931, Einstein compresses in the flight of four or five sentences the dimensions of ethnology, genetics, pictorial aesthetics, while also deploying the trope of escape. As the social symptom of this desire of an alteration of types, we remark among the primitives the exogamy, which in the final analysis is determined by a need to alter the constant type. One wants to break away from the imprisonment, Gefangenschaft, of the orderly standards, acquire unknown or new bodily and mental powers. Another means to achieve this goal was the transformation in animals, plants, currents, etc. The same drive is in operation if one tries today new relationships of form, Gestaltzusammenhänge, the foundational drama of metamorphosis, of a change of form, of Gestaltwandel, is played anew. That's easily possible in an image, for every form can signify a tremendous number of things. This is a complex passage which I will not even try to unpack here in depth. However, in view of what I'm going to discuss, I want to direct your attention to the combined metaphors of imprisonment and transformation with regard to body norms and genetic dependency, that is, to stasis, to non-change, to a lack of historical and cultural development. Einstein suggests, with a term drawn from ethnology, the practice of exogamy, the social arrangement where marriage is allowed only outside a social group, as a means of expanding the gene pool. For him, exogamy is to be set side by side with animistic or totemistic identifications with non-human entities. Such practices, which he seems to locate in prehistory, or rather outside Western modern culture, are being read as resources to escape a paralyzing biocultural condition of standardization and hence limitation. Einstein fast forwards to an alleged revival of metamorphosis in the contemporary moment of around 1930 and to the visual arts, to image, that is, as being particularly suited to work as a sort of stage for the foundational drama of Gestaltwandel. Art, in other words, is here being framed as an onto-escapologist practice, a scenery of escape that is not to be confused with any escapism that might immediately come to mind. Art, or rather the apprehension and making of pictures, is rendered as a medium of evasion, of escape into an altered, ontologically different reality, a reality of successful abandonment, or in Kerstin Starkemeyer's terms, abolition of the self, of active alienation. In a way, I would like to test the notion of Gestaltwandel in the context of this conference's emphasis on concepts of time, temporality, and history in relation to those of crisis and art. To this end, I will attend to the temporality and representability of metamorphosis as an ontological trope. Furthermore, I will argue that in the philosophical, poetological, and visual discourses of the 1930s, metamorphosis as a trope underwent a crisis, ultimately losing its appeal and credibility as a methodological device from the surrealist, that is, Bretonian toolbox. Put differently, metamorphosis itself changed shape, gestalt, and function. Seemingly more radical uses of metamorphosis are featured in the writings of Einstein, of Michel Leiris, and Georges Bataille, to only name a few. However this disclaimer is due, I will not venture into another in-depth reading of the various conceptual modelings of metamorphosis in interwar avant-garde practice and theory here. If I may, I direct you to the admirable work done by Christa Lichtenstern in her 1992 monograph Metamorphose vom Mythos zum Prozessdenken and Einstein scholars such as Klaus Herr Kiefer, Charlotte Weihrauch, Sebastian Zeitler, Maria Stafrinaki and Joyce Chang, the latter most recently in one of her contributions to our forthcoming publication. Rather, I will confine myself to some picks from the writings of around 1930, focusing on the motif of exiting, of getting out, of escape and or evasion, of fugitivity as an aesthetic and political condition. One, or rather the locus classicus of the avant-gardist theory of metamorphosis is the entry metamorphose in the critical dictionary that came with each issue, here number 6, 1929, of the journal Document. The term seemed important enough to have three of the key contributors of Document, interestingly leaving out Carl Einstein, though, write sub-entries. Marcel Griol focusing on Abyssinian games, Michel Leris pondering metamorphosis as a mode of transporting the self outside of the Western bourgeois ego, and Georges Bataille stressing animality. Leris famously posited the desire de mettre un homme véritablement hors de soi, to catapult a man truly outside of himself, note the gender restriction to this trip into the outside, as the preeminent goal of any real metamorphosis, inevitably resulting in an éclatant et violent paroxysme, in a spasmodic and probably painful decentering. Bataille gave his entry the title Animaux Sauvages, Wild Animals, and he drew on images of capture and captivity of cages and zoos, which he contrasted with the sheer animality of être illégaux et foncièrement libre, seul véritablement outlaws, of wild animals as illegal, fundamentally free beings, the only ones deemed to be called outlaws, since they remind us humans of what is irrevocably lost, an innocent cruelty, the opaque monstrosity of the eyes, the horror associated with a life lived like a tree in the sun, the world beyond civil identity, bureaucracy, statehood. At the same time, Bataille notices an obsession with metamorphosis, a violent need to mingle with each of our animal desires, excitant un homme à se départir par la nature humaine, an obsession that is to leave human nature altogether. Towards the end of the short text, Bataille evokes an imagery that is hauntingly close to the kind of illustrated reportage to be found in the popular Fait divers, or in the writings of Franz Kafka, for that matter. He writes, "In each man there is an animal locked in a prison, like a forced or slaved laborer, forçat, and there's a door, and once you open this door, the animal darts outside like the forced laborer who has found an exit. Provisionally, man dies and the beast behaves like a beast, without any concern to provoke the poetic admiration of death. It is in this sense that one regards a man like a prison with bureaucratic appearance." If with Bataille, wild animality is the desired state of being to be pursued, the crisis brought about by giving way to metamorphotic obsession ultimately results in the destruction of any security and groundedness, also in terms of historical placedness. Bataille, with his well-known aggressiveness towards all architecture and architecture's anthropomorphism in particular, deliberately articulates the movements of metamorphosis with the death-like stasis of prison architecture, which man inhabits and performs in characteristic immobility, sporting his trademark bureaucratic appearance. The bureaucraticism of human nature is to be evaded in order to reach the catastrophic pleasures of self-annihilation, which, as Bataille takes pain in underlining, However, Bataille is not content telling an adventurous tale of escape from prison or bagne. The narrative of liberation doesn't work for him, and neither it does for Einstein. At the time of writing his Fabrikation der Fiktion in the early or mid-1930s, Einstein had abandoned the utopian enthusiasm displayed in his chapter on Paul Klee or in the 1934 book on Georges Braque. With regard to metamorphosis as onto-escapology, Einstein sought the distance to his own embrace of processes of metamorphotic identification. In a 1931 lecture at the Kunstbibliothek in Berlin, he continued to associate such processes with an ongoing primitivization, a return to more primitive forms of economy and social structures, which he observed in the workers' movement and in Bolshevism. Somewhere on the way, these transgressive, anti-normative, and arguably proto-queer notions of Gestaltwandel and metamorphosis, however, must have lost traction. They became replaced in Fabrikation der Fiktion by Einstein's lament on a metamorphic liquidity and the fluid character of intellectual attitude that not only marks the liberal capitalist life forms, but is also to be understood as correlative with the mobility of capital itself. For him, the speculations and abstractions of intellectual and artistic discourse are structurally homologous to the speculations and abstractions of finance capital. Capitalism entgestaltet disfigures or deforms human beings and objects by force, and human beings and objects by force of abstract money, which is capitalism's mana. All unequivocal willing disappeared in the clamor of dashing metamorphosis, Einstein writes. And by stressing the transformability and malleability of commodities, their metamorphotic character, he signals less the Benjaminian, Baudelairean ephemerality of modernity, but rather the permanence of crisis as a problematic lack of reality. Quoting Bataille's phrase, metamorphic obsession, from a few years earlier, Einstein unfavorably compares any modern poet's efficiency of imagination with the modern speculant's desire of moving his money from placement to placement on the stock market as quickly as possible. Put differently, the Paleolithic or pre-Neolithic nomadism and animism, which in the late 1920s started to become constitutive of the retro-utopian horizon of Einstein's aesthetics, now appeared insufficient. After he had somewhat abandoned his elaborations on the dialectics of the hallucinatory and the tectonic in the paintings of Picasso in favor of André Masson's, Paul Klee's, and Georges Braque's alleged cosmogonic and neo-mythic metamorphism, their very liquidity of mind and form had become suspicious. The rush of metamorphosis in the present, isn't it just symptomatic of a recognition of concepts of subjectivity obeying to a capitalist logic? What metamorphotic identification might have promised in terms of onto-escapology, of exiting the imprisonment of biocultural norms, needed critical retooling in the face of economic, political, ideological, and socio-psychological developments. Though apparently not having much contact after the demise of Document, Einstein and Bataille shared many concerns into the 1930s, while arriving at quite different solutions and formulations. Or rather, Einstein simply didn't continue his quest for an ethnologically informed Nietzschean and arguably Jungian notion of a processual metamorphotic transgression of the confines of the capitalist heteronormative Western self, nor did he follow up on his self-abolishing reversal of this very neo-romantic aesthetics of escape as exercised in Fabrikation der Fiktion. Thus, in a way, he yielded the floor to Bataille. And Bataille, he elaborated and extended the trope of escape to the point where the Dionysian ecstasy of releasing man's inner wild animal became successfully drained of any centrifugal dynamic, of any expansive or eccentric movement. A key image concept to develop this centripetal, non-expansive escapology was the labyrinth, and the Minoan labyrinth in particular. Not only did Bataille came up with a name for the new magazine that Swiss publisher Albert Skira and Etheriat founded in 1933, Minotaure, together with André Masson, he worked tirelessly on a neo-mythological Nietzschean idea of a labyrinthic anthropology and ontology. An important text in this regard was published in the 1935-1936 issue of Recherche Philosophique, a journal edited by Antoine Coiré, Henri Charles-Puch, and Albert Speyer, and that focused on phenomenology, the impact of Heidegger in France, the history of religion, and related topics. Published as a yearbook, the fifth volume of Recherche Philosophique provided a four-part thematic concentration on the concept of time and concepts of time and temporality, featuring the likes of Pierre Klosowski, Roger Caillois, Georges Dumézil, and Lucien Louis-Brûl. In the review section, Jacques Lacan wrote on Eugène Minkowski's Le Temps Vécu. A smaller section was devoted to existence and being. Framed by articles by Jean Nogouet and Karl Löwith, Georges Bataille and Emmanuel Levinas were placed cheek by cheek or back to back with articles titled The Labyrinth and On Escape, De l'Evasion, respectively. What's striking about the juxtaposition of these texts is that they suggest a sequence of arguments, a relation between their alleged subjects, a liaison where one would lead to the other. Of course, this is not exactly what's happening here. Nonetheless, I'd argue Bataille and Levinas complement each other in an interesting, though quite certainly not intended, way. When his 1936 article was republished in 1982, Levinas wrote a short note to the editor stating that his old text was perhaps in a position to bear witness to an intellectual situation of meaning's end, when the existence attached to being forgot, on the eve of great massacres, even the problem of its own justification. Levinas mentions a consciousness of having no way out, sans issue, that in the mid-1930s was tied to a determined anticipation of impossible new thoughts. Entrapment or imprisonment being the precondition of anticipation, meaning's end, leading to the possibility of the unthought, this is a dialectical maneuver that renders escape, evasion, somehow superfluous, or doesn't it, or does it? Why this title on escape anyway? Levinas attempts an explanation early on in the text and makes reference to the genre of littérature d'évasion, to travel and adventure books, but probably also to Rimbaud's emblematic exclamation, J'ai eu raison de tous mes dédains puisque je me vade. This term escape, which we borrow from the language of contemporary literary criticism, is not only a word à la mode, it is a world weariness, the disorder of our time, mal du siècle, Levinas writes. The impossibility of getting out of the game and of giving back to things their toy-like uselessness heralds the precise instant at which infancy comes to an end and defines the very notion of seriousness. It is precisely from all that is weighty in being that escaping sets forth. With the vital urge we are going toward the unknown, but where we are going somewhere, whereas with escape we aspire only to get out, sortir. It is this category of getting out, assimilable neither to renovation nor to creation, that we must grasp in all its purity. It is an inimitable theme that invites us to get out of being. Thus, to the need for escape, being appears not only as an obstacle that free thought would have to surmount, nor even as the rigidity that, by inviting us to routine, demands an effort toward originality. Rather, it appears as an imprisonment from which one must get out. End of quote. Again, the vocabulary of law enforcement and breakouts is being deployed, in Levinas' case, in order to render palpable the most difficult ontological and ethical conceit, which I will leave here in its relative opacity. That is the aimless getting out of being, which Levinas contemplates as a response to the world weariness of the early 20th century. Interestingly, he marks the ending of infancy and the beginning of adulthood, of seriousness, as one of the thresholds to be crossed in the direction opposite to what is commonly expected, performing a kind of regressive leap. From Bataille's contribution to Recherche Philosophique, one shouldn't expect a serene monographic meditation on the theme of its title either. The labyrinth is everywhere and nowhere in this text, cluttered with allusions to Hegel, which doesn't have a center and is driven by an urgency that hides in the implicit. The labyrinth serves as an ontological backdrop for musings on the radical uncertainty of being, which can be anywhere outside of me, rather than being constantly addressed as a matter. The inevitable fatigue of the non-endurable being, Bataille posits, plunge humans into a foggy labyrinth formed by the multitude of acquaintances, of connaissances, with which signs of life and phrases can be exchanged. Society is empty, aimless communication, absolute insufficiency of a precarious authority constitutes the labyrinth, which is both inside and outside of each individual, rendering futile any attempt of escaping it. As Denis Ollier noted long ago, Bataille reverses the traditional metaphorical sense of the labyrinth that generally links it with the desire to get out. Bataille denounces the wish that it leads somewhere. Bataille's aggressive attacks against architecture are only superseded by his disdain for a future that is planned, for the projet that locks oneself into a devalorized present that is airless and unlivable. The project, according to Bataille, is the prison. Something that rings rather familiar after having learned about Levinas' ontological road to nowhere. What's more, there is a monster in the night of the labyrinth, which Bataille calls the universal, and which resembles a bull, sometimes absorbed in the nonchalance of animality, sometimes hurled by the rage of ruin into the void ceaselessly opened before it by a skeletal torero. In 1936, Bataille emphasizes the ontological freedom of man as he considers him to be free not to respond to any necessity. Further, man is free to resemble everything that is not himself in the universe. Bataille's chief interlocutor in the mid-1930s to envision and to visualize, or rather visceralize, such expanded metamorphism was the painter André Masson. In 1938, Masson painted this tortured anatomical architectural écorché vision of a body as run-down, bleeding, ruined building embedded in a barren landscape, featuring as its center, at the place of the stomach, a labyrinth. About 2 years earlier, in April 1936, Bataille was sitting in, I quote, in a little cold house in a village of fishermen, and end of quote, and Masson's and his family's retreat in Tossa del Mar on the southeastern Spanish coast. And while Masson in the nearby room is singing alongside a recording of the overture of Mozart's Don Giovanni, a piece of music that ties Bataille's lot in life to a challenge that opens him to a rapturous escape from the self, Bataille, pens the editorial of the first issue of the Journal Acéphale, dedicated to the theme of the sacred conspiracy and featuring the famous cover design by Masson. Bataille writes, "Man has escaped from his head, just as the condemned man has escaped from his prison. He has found beyond himself not God, who is the prohibition against crime, but a being that is unaware of prohibition. He is not me, but he is more than me. His stomach is the labyrinth in which he has lost himself, loses me with him, and in which I discover myself as him, in other words, as a monster." End of quote. Rather than rehearsing the rich literature on Bataille's acephalic anthropology, his use or abuse of Hegel in the notion of the unemployed negativity, his both anti-Marxist and anti-fascist attempts at mobilizing myth against myth, I'd like to conclude with the question of what Masson's and Levinas' centripetal onto-escapologies may have had to offer to the boys escaping the 1934 Belle-Île penitentiary and all other enslaved, incarcerated, and revolting prisoners and forced laborers for that matter. The September 1934 issue, which we've already seen, of Detective with the Île de Revolte story, featured this aerial, gloomy, majestic photo of a boy lying at the dock and staring on the water. The picture strikes me as the image of an almost Bataillean conceit of a boy Narcissus losing himself in his own image of maybe in the catastrophic vision of an agitated ocean where he and his comrades escape would quite certainly equal death. It is also the image, like any image of Narcissus, of time arrested, of no time. The condition atemporelle, the atemporal condition which Pierre Kolosowski writes about in an article on the monster de Sade in the first issue of Acephale, negates any development or progression. The imprisoned monster has stopped to live in permanent expectation. His soul gives up on any desire to see the object and breaks within it the movement of destructive time. For the revolting boys on the island in Brittany, such embrace of atemporality could have meant to enter or create a labyrinth or a mirror, a jungle of their own maybe, rather than pursuing the unpromising freedom of a life in the bureaucracy of the self. Another option for escaping the temporality of a false, unlivable present in selfhood without projecting an out there or a somewhere might be drawing on a decidedly prehistorical as well as geopoetic register. I would like to conclude my talk in two quick steps. First, by showing you these watercolors from a series titled The Nine Maidens from 1940 by the brilliant surrealist painter and occultist writer Ethel Colquhoun. Critical of surrealism's phallocentrism and worshipping of the Marquis de Sade, and instead increasingly interested in nature-woman relationships since the mid-1930s, this feminist artist envisioned states of transition and transformation of sexualized and gendered landscapes of prehistoric megaliths becoming the habitat, the womb, the fossil labyrinth for bodies to dwell in an atemporal condition. Such a shift of registers with regard to Acephale and related endeavors away from Nietzschean masculinism, yet connectable with a Bataillean fondness for Mother Earth, may bear similarities with the ontological shape-shifting, the metamorphic Gestaltwandel that Einstein had in mind around 1930 and abandoned afterwards. Moreover, and secondly, however, Colquhoun shares her interest in self-releasing communions with the deep times of geology and prehistory with writers such as Suzanne et Césaire Aimé, who around the same time in the early 1940s in their Martinican journal Topique, of which Suzanne Leib yesterday already told us, experimented with a poetry of the land and the island in particular, focusing on the body and calling for a universalism that is rich with all that is particular. Suzanne Césaire didn't celebrate an essentialist idea of nature, though, but established a fundamental relationship among all the elements existing on the island, looking through the camouflage of the beauty of Martinique onto a reality of exploitation. The most troubling reality, Suzanne Césaire contended, is our own. We shall act. This land, our land, can only be what we want it to be. Although this model of an escape would not be exactly a centrifugal one, it does not relinquish the generative potential of metamorphosis. In fact, carefully trying to avoid the pitfalls of escapism and fascism, the Césaires shuttled between deep time and future Africanisms, between a search for origins and a revolutionary opening, the potentials of which still need to be retrieved. Thank you.